we could have gotten change back from our bailout.
The $50 billion is almost three times the amount that the auto industry has asked for in a bailout. Madoff could have bailed out the auto industry three times.
$50 billion? It was around here somewhere. The Madoff collapse is proving to be a boom for lawyers and a takedown for pension funds, charitable foundations, and banks all over the world. While the big three wait for a miracle, another $50 billion just fell off of the train. It was around here somewhere on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 16th, and the Bernard Madoff story is astonishing in the details of how this alleged scam took place for so many years. We're going to have more on that story that's coming up. Also, new signs of life in an automaker bailout plan on Capitol Hill, and the question of who gets Hillary Clinton's Senate seat, that's heating up in New York. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
In a recession, people lose their jobs, people change career paths, their network. The same is true for an administration change in Washington. For the Secretary of Education, President-elect Barack Obama has tapped close to home Chicago Public Schools head Arne Duncan. The announcement is expected later today. Colorado Senator Ken Salazar is next in line for the Secretary of Interior post. Salazar is the second Hispanic member of the Obama cabinet, and the appointment leaves another Senate seat open.
In Illinois, the state legislature took the first step toward firing Governor Rod Blagojevich. Lawmakers voted unanimously to form a committee to consider impeaching him. Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn.
If he will not step aside or resign, he must be removed by the General Assembly through impeachment and conviction.
Yesterday, the governor went to work as usual, and he signed 11 bills into law. And in New York, Governor David Paterson has confirmed that Caroline Kennedy has talked to him about filling Hillary Clinton's soon-to-be vacant Senate seat.
She told me she was interested in the position. She realized that it was not a campaign, but she was talking to other people. She'd like at some point to sit down and tell me what she thinks her qualifications are.
Governor Paterson says he has not chosen a successor yet.
More details of the politics in New York about that Senate seat coming up. In Paris, a group demanding that France withdraw its troops from Afghanistan claims it planted dynamite at a major Paris department store. French officials say police have neutralized dynamite discovered in the bathrooms at the Printemps department store in Paris. Oil rose above $45 a barrel in Asian trading this morning. The Dow lost three quarters of a percent yesterday to close at 85.64. The S&P lost more than 2%. It's set to open at 868. All of the markets are waiting for what the Federal Reserve will do as its meeting concludes this afternoon. Barack Obama is going to announce his Secretary of Education today, as we said.
I'm a teacher myself. The way that the new Secretary of Education can be helpful is to start thinking about how we can measure kids' progress without suffocating them with standardized tests, Gantron sheets, and number two pencils.
So, come on. We want you to give the new secretary some advice. What does he need to start fixing on day one? What does your school system need? What is your child not getting in school? And if you could sit down with the Secretary of Education, what would you tell him? We want to hear that story at 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We have the issue of the auto bailout. My conversations with the White House are that I believe, as I have always believed, that they should use the TARP funding for this, and that the legislation we passed establishing TARP gives the White House that latitude to do that.
That's Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi yesterday suggesting there's new hope for the three U.S. automakers in their bid for billions from the White House. The White House could dip into TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Last week, Senate Republicans blocked an emergency loan package in Congress, but the Bush administration could act unilaterally. Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection in Washington, D.C., joins us. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
So the speaker sounds cautiously optimistic, but has anything really changed?
Well, nothing so far, except that there are reports out that the White House could make an announcement as early as tomorrow concerning using the TARP for an auto bailout. Now, whenever anybody says as early as, that means the soonest you'll hear is Wednesday and the latest you'll hear is never. So we'll see what happens. But they are starting to make signals that some emergency aid for the big three is on the way. In fact, in the way that Democrats in Congress said they wanted all along. Remember back a couple of weeks ago, the original fight over this auto bailout was the Democrats in Congress saying, yes, let's give them $34 billion or $25 billion or however that number changed, but let's take it from that TARP account, from that $700 billion we passed to help the failing financial services sector. Treasury, you have that money. Let's use that money. And the White House refused. Well, now the ball's right back in their court, and
it's dodgeball, though. This is dodgeball, Todd. I mean,
well,
nobody's actually catching the ball.
That's the way it works here.
The question is, are the automakers playing, or are they just losers here?
Well, they're sort of waiting on the sidelines at this point, because this game is between the Congress and the Treasury and the White House, and there's a chance it could get a little bit sticky here, John, and here's why. So they're talking about using the TARP money, as we know. We don't know how big the White House Treasury package is going to be, but there's only $15 billion left in that TARP account. So if they need more than that, or even something less, what if it's $14 billion? Well, they probably don't want to leave just $1 billion sitting in the TARP account. What if another bank fails and they need a rescue? So here's where it could get sticky. They've spent half of that money. They've spent $350 billion of the $700 billion. In order to get the second half, the Treasury has to apply to Congress for the second half. And the Democrats in Congress are already saying that Treasury's not going to get it, not under the conditions that they had it before. And why is that? Because they've been very dissatisfied that Paulson has refused to use any of the money to prevent foreclosures, direct aid to homeowners, that there hasn't been enough transparency in how the money's being spent, other things like curbing executive compensation. So what that means is that they're working on legislation now to rewrite some of the rules. They'll get that $350 billion eventually, but they're not going to get it without more strings attached. So,
and when you
Treasury
start talking about new legislation, that would require a vote, right?
That would require a vote. And here's the unknown, the wild card, Adora, is that we don't know when that vote would come. Now, ostensibly, it would come in the new Congress when the 111th Congress is back and everybody's here doing business. However, the automakers need their money quickly, they keep saying. And if this package is to be much bigger, than bigger at all than $15 billion, the $15 billion that's left in that account, then the auto bailout and the $350 billion, which is now tied up in a fight between Treasury and the Congress, could get all tangled up together. We don't know how that's going to work now.
So, Todd, last question. Where do things stand this morning when lawmakers head to their offices or they get on the phones? Are they just going to be working on that legislation, or is there still going to be some negotiating going on between, say, Nancy Pelosi and the White House?
Well, both of those things. There is negotiation going on. Now, Speaker Pelosi says she hasn't spoken to the White House in a couple of days, so they may do something unilateral, but they never do anything completely unilaterally because, again, they're going to have to work with Congress somehow. But that legislation that you mentioned is in the drafting stages right now. Pelosi also said she's working with Barney Frank, chairman of the Financial Services Committee, the man from Massachusetts who's been at the center of this. They're working on that legislation on a separate track. So all of these things are kind of dovetailing into in a way that we're not exactly sure how it's going to work out. It could go smoothly. If they happen in two separate tracks, there's a chance things could get weird.
So the automakers, still the big three, the big U.S. automakers, still have reason to be hopeful today.
Well, they do, because everybody is making all the noises that they're going to get some aid money. I think it's unclear how much it will be. It's unclear exactly what the conditions will be. Will it look like sort of the bill that the House passed a week and a half ago with conditions on, you know, what the cars are and with viability plans by March 31st? Will it look like that? Will it look something a little bit different? That's unclear. But they do look like they're going to get their money.
Todd Zwillick, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
I guess what would you call that? A lame duck session that goes after a lame duck session.
The idea that they would come back sometime soon just doesn't pass muster in my mind.
Without 60 votes in the Senate, I don't think they can do anything. But Todd's our guru.
He's our guy on the ground there.
So if you've noticed or not, by looking at the oil prices, the vast nation of Russia is caught in its own economic standoff. And the price of oil, which is declining, is creating a very chilly winter for a government that was rolling in cash just a few months ago. And, of course, there's no chillier winter than in Russia. The collapse of oil prices has put on hold billions of dollars in new development for oil and gas and other projects. It has stalled economic reform in Russia. It has reversed the Russian government's mission to restore its influence in Europe and all around the world. But perhaps the single most explosive element of the Russian predicament right now is the declining quality of life. James Rogers covers Russia for our partner, the BBC World Service. And I asked him what average Russians are feeling right now about their economy.
At the moment, probably people are very nervous about what's to come. I mean, let's think about the way this has gone. In the summertime, we were looking at those prices of $147 a barrel. If you'd asked people then, is oil likely to be close to $200 or $20 by the end of the year? I think most people would have said $200, and most of those people would, of course, have been wrong. So I think people are concerned about what's to come, and we're already seeing that trickling through into the rest of the Russian economy. New Year is the big holiday here in Russia. Travel agents are saying they're getting fewer bookings. Restaurants are reporting harder times, and there's a big question mark over just how much people are going to be spending in the shops in the run-up to that New Year holiday.
And part of that confidence problem relates to the cancellation of large industrial projects of various kinds, some in the oil industry, some sort of related to the oil industry, that really were dependent upon 140 and upwards prices of oil. What particular industrial sectors and geographic sectors of Russia have been affected?
Well, you've got to look at the way this country's gone in the last 20 years. There was chronic underinvestment in pretty much everything in the 1990s, the decade immediately following the collapse of communism. That's all been reversed, or at least that reversal has begun in the last decade. So there were a lot of public works projects, building Russia's infrastructure. There's some very poor roads once you get outside the capital here. That's where that money's going. And for the moment, those projects are still going on. But I think, again, there's a big question mark over them. The Russia had budgeted that next year it would have oil at around $90 a barrel, so it's having to redraw the state budgets to put that at around 50. The oil companies are having to do the same, and that, of course, is affecting their investment into new projects.
Well, give me a sense of a city you visited where projects that were in an aggressive state of spending are suddenly on hold and things are being canceled.
Well, I went to the city of Perm, which is in the Ural Mountains. It's two time zones from Moscow. It's really on the edge of the oil fields. Beyond there, you get into the Ural Mountains themselves, and then further east into Siberia. And people were saying there that the local government were saying that they are looking again at spending projects. I did visit one project where they were building a bridge. This was going to be a very important road link. Chatting to the workers there, they said, well, we hope the crisis isn't going to affect us. We're going to continue working on this. Other projects, though, they weren't so sure. There are big question marks, just as everybody's having to radically redraw their budgets for 2009.
And in Russia, unlike the United States, where there is a taxpayer revenue source for the government, I mean, when fossil fuels decline like this, it really deprives the government of almost its main source of revenue. I guess in the seconds before we go, a chilly winter in Russia this year, eh?
It certainly looks that way, I think, both for the government and for the private sector. Everyone hoping for better times next year.
James Rogers, BBC correspondent in Moscow, just back from the edge of the Ural Mountains on the rim of Siberia, where Russian investment is declining in the all-important oil industry. So, help for the new education secretary. You've got some for us.
I'm the principal of a public secondary school. I'd like to hope that the reform that we're looking for in education will harken back to Brown versus Board of Education and the U.S. Constitution that guarantees to every citizen equal protection under the law, and that will really guarantee an equal education with equal facilities and equal access to every student in our country.
Equal education, do you have that in your kids' school system, or how do you think you could get that? Give us your thoughts for the new Secretary of Education, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. More transition today. Barack Obama is going to announce his Secretary of Education, and we're asking you to give the new secretary some help from the perspective of your own school. What's the biggest problem at your school? What does your school need? Grab the phone out of your parents' hands and call us. Do you think the Secretary of Education needs to do anything in particular on day one? Tell us your stories about what's wrong with the educational system from your school district's perspective and what they need at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Illinois politics have taken a scandalous turn as the governor there pondered who to appoint to Barack Obama's Senate seat. Here in New York, another high-profile story for another reason entirely. Caroline Kennedy, according to reports, has thrown her hat into the ring, expressing interest in the seat Senator Hillary Clinton will vacate when she becomes Secretary of State. But there have been rumors for weeks, yet little movement, and some Democrats have openly questioned her credentials. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is with us to give us her take. A complicated candidate, huh?
A very complicated candidate, an extremely private person whose major act in public life, other than endorsing Barack Obama and going to a number of his speeches and rallies, was working to raise money for the New York City public schools. But she was so private that the WNYC local newsroom tried to interview her for a year, and she declined. So now she's about to take another step into public life. She seems to have called every elected official in New York yesterday to express interest in this position. But even the person that she hired to handle her quote-unquote campaign wasn't talking to us.
And after the rumors, I mean, we've been hearing that potentially she would throw her hat in the ring for many weeks now. And yesterday, Governor David Paterson, who will be appointing Clinton's successor, he had this to say about it.
She told me she was interested in the position. She realized that it was not a campaign, but she was talking to other people. She'd like at some point to sit down and tell me what she thinks her qualifications are.
Her qualifications, which some people have said, other than being famous, she really doesn't have any.
Well, what happened is, after the initial expression of checking out whether she might be interested, there was a blowback, particularly among some of these members of Congress, people who want the seat themselves or people who've been working in the trenches for a long time.
But isn't there something sexist about that? I mean, nobody ever asked that question about John Jr. What did he ever do except wander around with, you know, his gym shorts on and run a magazine into the ground?
You know, New Yorkers like to put their hands on their elected officials. They like to embrace them, maybe box with them. She's been someone that's been at something of a reserve. And a lot of this is coming from, you know, women elected officials or women public policy experts who feel she's been so far in the background that they don't know who she is. Now, Hillary Clinton had the same thing, which she resolved by spending 2 years in New York and having this listening tour and sleeping in people's living rooms and letting them get to know her. This is obviously a very abbreviated schedule, but one of the things that will certainly happen if Caroline Kennedy does indeed become the next U.S. Senator from New York is she is going to have to go out and press the flesh and meet people and become close to people.
She'd need
to
take a class. She'd need probably to take a class in sleeping in other people's living rooms.
I mean, this would be a huge step for her because she has lived her entire life in a very private way, and she'd have to really come out in public and be a very public person in a state that tends to jostle its public officials.
But there certainly are others, as you mentioned, who are interested or whom the governor may be interested in. You want to give us a sense of who those people are?
Right. There's the state attorney general, Andrew Cuomo, who was once married to her cousin, Carrie Kennedy, although they're now divorced. There is Caroline Maloney, who is a candidate that a lot of women's groups have gotten behind. She's a congresswoman from Manhattan and worked particularly on trying to get aid to New York after 9/11.
Congresswoman,
right.
Too.
Right. And the other name that's been mentioned, although it's problematic for the Democrats, is a relatively new congresswoman, Kirsten Gillibrand, from the middle and upstate of New York. But she holds a seat in a district that was always held by a Republican who left in scandal and would very likely return to Republicans. And there's clearly a priority on the part of both Governor Patterson, who's running in 2010, and Barack Obama to have a candidate who can raise millions and millions of dollars and has a big national profile, so that seat won't be a problem for New York.
But Patterson also needs to worry about his upstate votes, and so appointing someone upstate would have its own logic.
It would, although Caroline Kennedy, I think, sort of transcends upstate, downstate, so it does solve that dilemma for Governor Patterson.
And just to be clear, I mean, the governor has the absolute discretion to name the successor.
He does have the absolute discretion, and it's pretty clear to me that the Barack Obama transition team has pulled way back because of the problems that are in Illinois and are going to leave it up to Patterson to make up his mind in this case.
Okay, and I understand we have a listener's thought on the idea of Caroline Kennedy becoming a senator.
You know, if Ms. Kennedy really wants to go into politics, that's fine. She probably has some talents to offer, but why doesn't she start at a local level, or why doesn't she start at a state level? God knows the people up in Albany need some help. But no, just to be handed a U.S. Senate seat on what? Her name. She has no experience, and this is not a throwback to the campaign, but I mean, seriously, meritocracy is being stabbed in this thing.
That's a sentiment that you see a lot on the blogs and that you certainly hear people say here in New York.
Yes, and it's very interesting because on the one hand, New Yorkers really do want someone who's worked for it. On the other hand,
they
New Yorkers
Hillary Clinton.
Want somebody famous. This was the seat that was held by her uncle, Robert Kennedy.
Thank you very much, Andrea Bernstein, our takeaway political director with the scoop as always.
So Caroline Kennedy, you know, she's part of the dynasty. In some ways, Hillary Clinton is part of the Clinton dynasty. So there's a definite precedent for dynastic succession. I mean, we learned yesterday, which was so fascinating, that Jack Kennedy had his roommate hold the seat so that his brother could run for it in 2 years.
Well, that's what they say essentially happened with Joe Biden's seat in Delaware, right? They put a placeholder in so that when his son, Beau Biden, comes back from Iraq, that he can run for that Senate seat in 2 years.
Well, headlines of the future, but of the present, Femi Okeh is here.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. The Fed is widely expected to ratchet down a key interest rate when it wraps up a two-day meeting today. Many economists predict the Fed will cut the rate in half to just 0.5%. A transition official for President-elect Barack Obama says that Colorado Senator Ken Salazar has been picked to run the Interior Department. Salazar is expected to balance the protection of natural resources while tapping the nation's energy potential. Salazar's appointment means another Senate vacancy. And later this morning, Barack Obama is expected to announce that he's picked Arne Duncan to be his Secretary of Education. Duncan's been heading Chicago public schools for the last 7 years. As the SEC digs deeper into the financial web of accused investment schemer Bernard Madoff, the Washington Post says that the SEC ignored repeated warnings about Madoff, one as early as 1999. The Post says that the agency only started looking into Madoff's investment business last week. That's a look at some big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, Barack Obama will announce his Secretary of Education nominee, and we're asking for all and every kind of advice for the new secretary.
Make the class sizes smaller. Currently, I have 26 to 28 students in five classes. That's over 125 children a day that I must educate.
Smaller classrooms, more resources, better teachers. What's your thought on how we can make education in America better? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
We're hearing from a lot of teachers this morning at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And whether it's more parental involvement that's needed in schools, whether it's more resources that's needed in school, or more accountability for teachers, all are hot button issues. And when later today Barack Obama names who is expected to be the 7-year reform-minded school chief of the Chicago Public Schools, Arne Duncan, to be education secretary, all of those issues will be on the table. The news conference is going to be significant for where it's taking place, and you should pay attention to that later today. It's at Chicago's Dodge Renaissance Academy, and that's one of the schools that Arne Duncan is credited to have turned around during his tenure. Joining us now is Veronica Anderson, editor-in-chief of Catalyst Chicago, a magazine that reports on school reform in the Windy City. Veronica, what do you think the symbolic significance of this nominee is in terms of his close relationship with Barack Obama, and also in terms of the successes that Arne Duncan has had in the Chicago public school system?
Well, you're certainly right in that the location of this press conference is significant. It's being held at Dodge Elementary School, the prototype of these school turnarounds and what they've called here the Renaissance Schools Movement in Chicago. Dodge Elementary was a school that was not doing well at all, and the district, Arne Duncan, closed the school back in 2002. It was shut down for a year, and then it reopened under new management. An outside organization ran it both as a school and as a teacher training center. And since the school has reopened, the scores have gone up significantly.
Is that,
so it's symbolic in that regard.
Is that the only measure of the success of the school? Because I'm wondering if Barack Obama is trying to signal here that maybe No Child Left Behind is going to be modified in some way under his new administration, or if it's going to be continue with the program business as usual.
It certainly is not the only measure that the school is doing better. And as a matter of fact, if you look at some of the things that Arne Duncan has accomplished as CEO of schools in Chicago, they certainly have gone beyond just the two-dimensional look at test scores and whether they've gone up or down. In Chicago, he has done a lot to expand school choice. In fact, under that Renaissance 2010 program, Arne Duncan has opened 75 new schools, many of them in neighborhoods that have been identified as needing better options. He's also presided over what has become known as a fairly innovative turnaround strategy, where schools were closed down without displacing the children and then reopened within a few months with a new staff, a new academic program, and you've seen a lot of things get better, not just test scores, but the overall school climate. The safety and communities and parents have been happy with what they've seen.
Veronica, it almost seems as if Arne Duncan is the quintessential Barack Obama nominee in that this is a man who has really bridged the gap between the raging debate among those who call themselves reformers and those who represent more of the teachers' unions in that they're wanting more resources. And he seems like someone who really has been able to take bits and pieces from both sides of the debate.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, there have been two schools of thought, as you've mentioned, and I'm sure both sides would call themselves reformers of sorts. But you've got one group that embraces the idea that what happens inside of classrooms is not enough and that more resources need to be invested in tackling the effects of poverty and how that affects children. The other group believes that it's time to raise the bar performance for teachers and principals yet again and get those folks to do more. During his 7-year tenure in Chicago, Arne Duncan has certainly dabbled on both sides. I mean, you've seen him implement a pretty expansive after-school program, which paves the way for children in Chicago. Chicago has a very short school day. It paves the way for more learning opportunities for those children. And then on the other side, you've seen bonus pay programs for star teachers, star principals, and administrators. Duncan is sometimes criticized for not having a classroom experience and for, you know, just doing their daily's bidding. But certainly, President-elect Obama has a defined vision for improving public schools, and Arne Duncan has shown in Chicago he can execute his boss's vision.
Well, quickly then, I mean, the federal government has a kind of a troubled role in the broad national school picture in that it only really supports about 14% of the resources. In a situation where we are having this economic downturn and the schools do need more resources, is the federal government going to be able to come up with the resources that schools need, or is Arne Duncan someone who has a reputation in Chicago of doing more with less?
Well, that's certainly a very good question, because Chicago has dealt with its share of a fairly strapped financial climate for a number of years. In fact, Arne Duncan and others at the school board go downstate every year to Springfield asking for more money, and there's been a fairly long battle here to get some sort of reform.
So he's got experience in those kinds of battles. I guess the two of them met, Arne Duncan and Barack Obama, in the 90s playing pickup basketball games. I guess we're going to find out if he's an outside shooter or somebody who works inside the paint. Veronica, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Veronica Anderson is editor-in-chief of Catalyst Chicago, a school reform magazine, talking about Arne Duncan, who is expected to be nominated for Secretary of Education. And this just in, inflation has plunged by a record level, 1.7%. That's the decline in consumer prices. It's a good sign for consumers, but also an indication of the recession. More headlines now from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. Time coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Also getting some housing starts figures in for November. Number of new houses starting off, and November they fall more than expected. They hit a record low of 625,000. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that she's talked with a key committee chairman about passing a bill to control the $700 billion financial rescue fund. Pelosi says the aim is to make sure that the $350 billion that's left is used to help out people who are facing mortgage foreclosures. Officials and a witness say that a suspected U.S. missile strike has killed two people in a militant stronghold in Pakistan. The strike in the North Waziristan tribal region appears to be the latest in a surge of alleged U.S. missile strikes on Pakistani territory. French police have neutralized five sticks of explosives discovered today in a prestigious Paris department store. France's national news agency says that it received a claim of responsibility from a group calling itself the Afghan Revolutionary Front, saying that several bombs have been planted in the Printemps department store. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news for this morning. John,
it's sort of reassuring, that French story, because I was thinking Mumbai for a minute, but It looks like the dynamite was very low grade and not the kind of tactics we saw in Mumbai.
That's right.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and we're going to turn our attention now to the story about the Iraqi reporter who threw his shoes at President Bush. He's become somewhat of a folk hero. The BBC reports in a 24-hour period, nearly a million people watched the video. Several thousand people have demonstrated in Baghdad and other cities for the shoe hurler's release. For more on the continuing reaction in the Arab world, we're joined now by Mark Sirwa, the managing editor of the Daily Star in Beirut. Good morning, or I should say good evening to you, but thanks very much for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
This story has taken on a life of its own. Describe what the reaction has been like.
Well, I think many people are endorsing what amounted to an act of protest against Mr. Bush's policies for the past several years, in Iraq in particular, but across the Middle East in general. Many people feel that they've been disempowered by his actions and his policies. And the gentleman in question, I think, just sort of acted out on impulse.
And we've heard reports that people have been walking around with shoes in their belts in support of him.
Well, you've seen all sorts of manifestations of this. People in Gaza, there are pictures of people painting Bush's name on the bottom of their shoes. in Baghdad. They're pinning their shoes to their protest placards. Here in Beirut, I've seen a couple of guys walking down the street with shoes hanging off their belt. It's just become an instant symbol of protest against American policy.
Mark, in a world where, you know, Tina Fey becomes a giant global megastar for making fun of the Alaska governor during a presidential campaign, how much of this is kind of a function of the YouTube world we live in, or something very particular to the frustration in Iraq?
Well, the shoe is a traditional means of expressing disrespect when used in a particular way in Arab cultures. I mean, even back home, I mean, if somebody rubs a shoe on your face, he's not doing it because he likes you. But here, there's a particular measure. I mean, you're supposed to take off your shoes if you enter a mosque, for instance. So there's a particular measure of disrespect that is communicated by that we saw when, for instance, when they tore down statues of Saddam after the invasion in 2003, that people were hitting the statue with their shoe. To have the same kind of symbol used against Mr. Bush, I think, is just a repudiation of what he's been held responsible for here. And I don't think a lot of people in the West are aware that there's a very particular brand of humor in the Arab world. That has a bit of irony to it and sarcasm, and it was just taken off like wildfire here.
And how has the media been reporting not only the protest but the reaction to it other than the protests?
Well, the media is like media anywhere else. If there's a story that's not especially hard news, but it appeals to their audience, they're going to go after it. And some of them will even cite their own editorial positions. For instance, there's a television station here in Lebanon that has offered the gentleman a job. And if he accepts, they will pay him retroactively to the moment when he tossed the first shoe at Mr. Bush.
that's interesting.
Love that.
Yeah, no, very strong reaction. Mark Sirwa, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mark Sirwa is the mayor and managing editor of the Daily Star in Beirut. And he was telling us about the Arab world's reaction to the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush, calling him a dog.
Everyone in Iraq is just two shoes away from a job in Arab media. That's good to know.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Tuesday, December 16th, and headlines now from Femi Oke.
Hello there. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. New York Governor David Patterson confirmed yesterday that Caroline Kennedy has contacted him about filling Hillary Clinton's soon-to-be vacant Senate seat. He says she'd like to meet to go over her qualifications. French police say that they've defused sticks of dynamite that were found in the restrooms of the Printemps department store in Paris. The French news agency AFP received a letter from an Afghan revolutionary group taking credit for the explosives. As the SEC digs deeper into the financial web of accused investment schemer Bernard Madoff, the Washington Post says the SEC ignored repeated warnings about Madoff, one as early as 1999. The Post says the agency only started to look into Madoff's investment business last week. Now, earlier this morning, we spoke to Robert Chu, who invested in the Madoff scheme. Now, until last week, he had over $1 million.
I have a business and I have clients, and so we weren't living completely off the interest, although we have relatives that were. And I think what happens is when you get into a situation like this and the money seems easy, you kind of, you know, you don't have to work quite as hard. And that, I guess that's the great lesson we all can take away from this.
That's Robert Chu, president and founder of PFI Communications. He lost over $1 million last week in the Madoff scheme. Colonoscopies are much less accurate than doctors thought. That's according to a new Canadian study published in a medical journal today. Some doctors thought they'd prevented 90% of cancers, but it's actually closer to 60%. Despite the decrease, researchers say the test is still highly effective and patients should continue to do it. That's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. We also got a record decline in consumer price index, a record decline in inflation led by the collapse of energy prices, as we all know about. Markets poised to open sort of flat to positive as they wait for the decision of the Federal Reserve on interest rates. In this financial crisis, the question of the regulatory responsibility of the Securities and Exchange Commission, as referred to by Femi a moment ago, has been central to the debate over how we got here. But in an era of credit, default swaps and other kinds of derivative securities way beyond traditional stocks and bonds, a gray area has opened up that seems to dwarf the old school brokerages and banks. Well, into this gray area walked veteran investor Bernard Madoff, who reportedly last week confessed to a self-described Ponzi scheme, which has bilked investors out of possibly as much as $50 billion. So could he have been stopped by the feds, or was he invisible in this new era of exotic investments? It's the question posed this morning by New York Times regulatory reporter Stephen Labaton. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, we look at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and, you know, it seems like a completely different planet in 2008 than the SEC was traditionally meant to regulate. Where should the SEC have been in taking a look at Madoff's particular scheme here?
Well, there were lots of warning signs over the years, and there were people who were complaining to the SEC that that Madoff's program looked suspicious. And in effect, the agency did virtually nothing.
And Madoff had two programs. I mean, there was a traditional sort of brokerage, and then there was this Bernie's so-called hedge fund, which was on a different floor of the office building where he had his operations. Does the SEC look at both of those operations the same way or differently?
They look at it differently. The brokerage is very is supposed to be much more heavily regulated. The investment advisory service is very lightly regulated, although he did register it in September of 2006. And normally, once you register, you're supposed to be inspected within a year, and then every 5 years or so since. But it never was.
Well, is the reason that that never happened possibly because Madoff had such a reputation on the street? His brokerage had been around forever. His reputation for success seemed to be absolutely airtight and squeaky clean, and that the SEC possibly looked at him as someone they didn't need to look at.
He did have a very strong reputation, and he also had a blue-chip listing of clients. But the resources of the commission are also very thinly stretched in this area, and their budget and number of officials has declined since 2005, and so that's an important part of the story as well.
Stephen, he was investigated by the SEC several times. What happened, say, in 2005 and 2007? Were there any consequences for violations that the SEC found?
There were some very minor technical violations by his broker-dealer, for which he received a modest fine. But the investigators were looking in the wrong place and never followed up on the more serious accusations that are at the core of the stories now.
I guess the question is, where were they looking? Because, Bernard, at least according to the reports that we're seeing, Bernard Madoff has told the feds that almost all of the paper that he generated in this financial advisory hedge fund firm of his was completely fake. If they had attempted to verify almost any annual statement, they would have found that it was bogus.
They were looking at his broker-dealer operations and the way in which they executed trades. They weren't looking at the investment advisor and the whole operation on the in the black hole on the 17th floor that he was operating out of the building that they were was providing the investment advice.
So that stayed completely under the radar. I guess,
That's right.
On some level, this is an old story. The reason there's an offshore economy is it because onshore there are regulations. The reason there are things like mutual funds is because the regulatory environment for funds and mutual funds that actually dabble in other mutual funds and credit default swaps and all these sorts of exotic securities that have grown up over the last decade or so or even more is because the economy tends to migrate away from an area where the regulatory light is bright and into an area where it's not so bright. Is Madoff any different than that dynamic that's gone on for years and years?
Well, in that sense, he is not. I mean, a lot. The operation that that looks to be fraudulent was exempted until he registered it in September of 2006 from him registering and facing all those examinations. But that being said, in hindsight now, there were so many telltale signs of problems that that nobody looked at closely, that one looks at this operation and is astounded.
Since Stephen, and clearly it's going to be dissected, so much of what he's done over the last years, but it also makes me wonder how many other Madoffs are there out there? If the SEC is not looking in the right place, could it only be with just Madoff's company?
Well, you can expect as a consequence of this that there will be postmortems at the commission, and there will be the next administration, which will be coming in a few weeks with their own new set of regulatory leaders, are going to look very carefully at this case and make recommendations, and I think we'll have no problem if they want it, increasing the staff and the size of the commission, seeking possibly, you know, a new set of regulations on hedge funds. I mean, you may recall that the Bush administration was very opposed, and the leaders of the SEC for many years, to requiring hedge funds to register, although many of them do voluntarily, many of them do not. And this is going to be in the midst of a much bigger debate about overhauling the regulatory architecture.
Finally, Stephen, and quickly, you're an expert on these regulatory issues, and Christopher Cox has not looked well in all of this. He's the head of the SEC. He claims that more resources are needed and more authority is needed. But what is the precedent here? Does the SEC really need explicit authority to look for crooks in areas that are lightly regulated, or can they do it on their own? And is that really the problem here?
That's not the main problem. I mean, clearly, This was a fraud in plain sight, and it could have been detected if somebody was looking in the right place. But it is also true that there is, according to people like Arthur Levitt and others, a deeply demoralized staff at the commission, a very top-down management structure, and one can expect that the next administration is going to look very carefully and probably overhaul the enforcement programs.
Certainly a day one issue for the Obama administration. Stephen Labaton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Labaton, a reporter for The New York Times. His piece on the SEC and what red flags were missed in the Bernard Madoff scandal is in today's New York Times.
Another important issue on Barack Obama's agenda, the Secretary of Education. He is expected to nominate his choice today. And here's some advice for the new person.
The key: let children know that school is cool.
Arnie Duncan, who is the CEO of the Chicago Public School System, is expected to get that nod. And then some of you gave parents advice instead.
You need to turn off the TV, put away the Nintendo, and stop passing the buck to teachers only. If your kid isn't doing a good job in school, sit down and do their homework with them instead of just letting them play Nintendo all night long.
So tell us, what do you think the new Secretary of Education is going to need to start fixing the systems, or the many systems, on day one? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Lots of good responses today.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Bernanke turns the key. Under the hood of the U.S. monetary system, they are running out of levers to pull to get the money moving. The Federal Reserve will try one more time. So which would you choose to stimulate the economy, Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve, or a 66 Mustang V8? Gentlemen, start your engines. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 16th. Good morning, John. And
good
today,
morning,
of course,
Adora.
Many eyes will be on Ben Bernanke as the Fed Reserve meets, and many expect another interest cut is going to be in the works. In Minnesota, they're still counting Senate votes. The race is down to just hundreds of ballots. And a new report challenges the effectiveness of tests for colon cancer. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
The economy may be in a stall. New economic numbers just out this hour. Consumer prices plunged 1.7% last month. It's the biggest drop in more than 60 years. New home construction plummeted last month, too, dropped almost 19%. Both numbers are at all-time lows, breaking records that were set last month. That ratchets up pressure on the Fed to cut its key interest rate again. An announcement is expected around 2:30 this afternoon. We'll see how investors react. Right now, Dow futures are pointing to a flat but slightly positive opening, mostly waiting for the Fed.
Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are drafting legislation to demand the White House to do more to reduce home foreclosures. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the Bush administration has ignored that part of the bailout plan. She says they'll have to change that before they can get the second installment of the $700 billion. The auto industry is still hoping for a bailout of its own. Michigan Senator Carl Levin.
It would be unthinkable that our government not do what every other government is doing to support our auto industry.
The White House could act as early as Wednesday to approve an automaker bailout from its bank rescue fund.
President-elect Barack Obama is expected to announce that he's chosen Arne Duncan to be his Secretary of Education. Duncan's been leading up Chicago's public schools for the past 7 years. And Colorado Senator Ken Salazar is next in line for the Secretary of Interior post. Salazar is the second Hispanic member of the Obama cabinet, and the appointment leaves yet another Senate seat open for appointment by a governor. They call it the world's most exclusive club for a reason. The U.S. Senate is tough to get into. Caroline Kennedy wants to try. New York Governor David Patterson said she called him to express her interest in Hillary Clinton's seat, which used to be her Uncle Bobby's seat long, long ago. Oil rose above $45 a barrel in Asian trading this morning. The Dow lost 0.75% yesterday to close at 85.64. The S&P begins trading today at 8.68. And as we said, the markets are waiting for the Federal Reserve to make its decision.
And some are waiting for Barack Obama to announce his Secretary of Education. And we want your advice for that new secretary.
The new Secretary of Education should provide services for the poor comparable to what the rich get.
Equality in education, how do you think we get there? What's your advice to the new secretary on how to better the education system in this country? 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. What's it going to take?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm sure you've noticed, but in the daily coverage of the auto industry bailout cliffhanger, every day we've had another tortured metaphor where the auto industry is in need of a haircut or is in need of a sort of electroshock to save the patient. Well, today is a day to kind of turn the linguistic tables on economic coverage because perhaps in describing the meeting of the Federal Reserve today, we can use an automotive metaphor to describe what's going on there. The central bank is going to wrap up 2 days of deliberations with an announcement on a key interest rate. Basically, the Fed is lifting up the hood of the economy and seeing if there's any levers it can pull to stimulate lending in the economy. And analysts are looking for a reduction of a half percentage point from the current 1% interest rate. Lowering the interest rate is a lever the Fed pulls to stimulate the economy. Joining me to talk about decision day for the Fed is Dan Gross, who's a senior editor at Newsweek. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
Is this a big day? Are you like on pins and needles, or is this something for the statisticians?
It's a little early for pins and needles. Maybe some just blunter pins.
Blunt pins. Rods and needles.
Look, at this point, things are so telegraphed that the announcements are, I don't want to say anticlimactic, but it's not like we're going to get big surprises. We know what's going on in the economy. We know what the data points are, and we know that we're going to get an interest rate cut.
But what we don't know is the uncharted waters that we are in as the Federal Reserve's interest rate, key interest rate, gets down close to zero. And to help us to negotiate these waters, we've asked Vincent Reinhart to join us. He's a former director of monetary policy of the Federal Reserve. He's also a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Vincent, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So you have written, and in a paper co-authored by none other than Ben Bernanke, about what happens when the Fed gets down close to zero. It really begins to run out of traditional options for stimulating the economy when the interest rate gets so low. First of all, are we close to having no more levers? And secondly, what new levers do we have to find?
So we're close to having no more traditional levers in terms of the federal funds rate. The federal funds rate right now is one percentage point. That means they can cut it 50 basis points twice. That's about it. But there are many other things that a central bank can do when it's in the neighborhood of the zero bound to nominal interest rates.
Well, let's talk about some of those. And are we likely to see that in the fine print of the Fed announcement, which comes at about quarter after 2 or 2:30 this afternoon? You've mentioned one in a paper that you wrote that I actually scanned through last night. That would be the federal government purchasing large amounts of financial assets to boost interest rates or boost economic activity elsewhere in the economy. How does that work?
So the Federal Reserve's already doing that. And in fact, an announcement about the interest rate, whether they cut it 50 basis points as everybody expects or whether they do it more, isn't particularly interesting. What's interesting is will they admit that they're now in an era of non-traditional policy action? For the last 2 months, the Federal Reserve has significantly increased the size of its balance sheet. Your central bank has a $2 trillion balance sheet. In doing so, they put a lot more reserves into the banking system than it is necessary to keep the federal funds rate at its target of 1%. In fact, the federal funds rate, that's the overnight price of reserves, has been trading around, you know, an eighth of one percentage point for the last month.
And indeed, T-bills yields, are close to zero. There's a lot of sort of zero interest rate financing in the economy, yet for consumers and for other areas of the economic system, there is not the confidence to free up money for broad lending, for corporate and other economic activities. Why?
Because that easing hasn't passed through to broader markets, mainly because the firms at the very center of our global trading system, the large complex financial institutions, are really scared, and they're trying to conserve their balance sheet. They have bad assets. That's put a hole into their capital positions. So they're all hunkering down. They're not making new commitments. They're not supporting market activity. They're not making new loans.
And, Vincent, in terms of trying to ease that fear, you say or you argue that the Treasury has been inconsistent in the policies it's put forth. Do you want to explain how and what you think they should be doing?
So that's a discouraging story. We gave our Secretary of Treasury unprecedented authorities to buy assets. Remember that two government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac,
sure,
are under government control. The TARP is $700 billion. The Secretary could have bought assets in volume and supported the price. Instead, he acted inconsistently and added in uncertainty to already an uncertain time. And the net effect was to deter private capital from coming into the financial sector. And if private capital doesn't come in, the government's going to have to replace it. That's
well,
the position we're in now.
Just reminding people of the bidding. I mean, they put their toe in the water on distressed assets, then pulled their toe out. Then they said they were going to buy equity in banks, which they actually started to do. The Fed actually did put $500 billion or so behind Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and that had a real effect on mortgage rates. But now, you know, we're talking about reducing the interest rate once again. If confidence is a problem, how is explicitly saying today, as the Federal Reserve, you say, is likely to say, that we're in uncharted waters, we're in non-traditional zone? I mean, isn't that going to be translated by the economy as like abandoned ship?
The other way to say it is, don't worry, we have a lot more tools at our disposal. We have an unlimited central bank. We are willing, unlimited balance sheet. We are willing to increase the amount of reserves. We are willing to accumulate assets, and we will continue to do so until our policy action gets traction.
Okay, let's just test, Vincent, how this is working. Dan Gross, is that reassuring to you?
I think so. Yeah, look, you know, Mr. Reinhart and Bernanke wrote a paper in 2004 that they presented that talked about not just what the Fed actually does in the short term, but shaping interest rate expectations in the future. And I guess I'm curious as to what we should be looking for to how the Fed would shape that. Is it the body language of Bernanke? Is it the rhetoric he uses? Is it his reputation for being a scholar of the Great Depression and someone who's concerned about deflation? When we're looking to shape these expectations, which is an important component about it, because it's not just about what people are going to do today. It's they're thinking, what should I be doing 3-6 months from now?
Oh, got it. Great. That's great.
What should we be looking for?
Where do we look to feel better, Vincent?
So you first look in today's statement to see that the Federal Reserve acknowledges that it isn't just today's interest rate that matters anymore, that it will use its balance sheet, both the size and its composition, now and into the future to support economic activity. This is a turning point for the Federal Reserve. It now is its chance to acknowledge that it's in this new territory. Also remember that in monetary policy world, January and February is very busy. There's lots of testimonies. There's a semi-annual report that goes to the Congress in mid-February. So what I think what will happen is today they'll indicate they're turning the boat, and then over the next month or two, they'll give you more details about exactly how explicit they will be in, among other things, shaping expectations.
All right. Well, that all sounds fine, but I'm looking at your paper that you wrote with Ben Bernanke, Vincent, and also Brian Sack. And one of the cautionary tales in that paper is that Japan spent years down around the so-called zero boundary of extremely low interest rates. And it meant a decade-long recession, or at least a stagnation in that country. How do we avoid the Japanese scenario here?
So there's good news and bad news. The good news is the Japanese didn't embrace the authorities they had until very late in the game. When they brought interest rates down to zero, they kept talking about how those rates were abnormally low and how it was very important to correct those expectations. And that's exactly the point about shaping expectations that Mr. Gross just made. If you keep talking about how you're going to have to pull rates back up pretty soon, like the Japanese did, you don't get as much traction for the rate cut you do make. So expectations are important. Bad news is, we think we have a lot of tools at a central bank's disposal in terms of the size and composition of its balance sheet and its ability to shape expectations. They're basically untried. That's why there's more uncertainty.
More uncertainty.
And that's why, among other things, the Federal Reserve was so aggressive in the second half of this year in lowering the federal funds rate, because it didn't really want to get in this position.
And now it's in the new toolbox. Well, Vincent, I saw you getting battered around on CNBC last night. I hope you feel a little more comfortable getting your say here on our program.
It's never a good experience.
It's never a good experience. Right? Well, thanks for joining the Takeaway. Vincent Reinhardt is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a former Federal Reserve official. Dan Gross, are you reassured by that? It sounds like they're dipping into a whole new tool case today.
I think the great problem with the past year is that the traditional moves have not worked. We cut interest rates, which is what the Fed is supposed to do, but instead of getting passed through to consumers, banks basically absorb that to cover all their losses.
Well, hold on, Dan. We're gonna stay with you, and we're going to test those new levers definitely all week long. Dan Gross is a senior editor at Newsweek, joining us here on The Takeaway. Thanks, Dan.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I just want to tell you that I truly believe that we have, in Volkswagen, the very best manufacturing partner that this state and this county and this city could ever have, and I want to thank them so much for being here.
That's Tennessee Senator Bob Corker talking in July, drawing a line in the sand, essentially. And that sentiment goes a long way to explaining why many Southern lawmakers have been opposing the bailout for the big three U.S. automakers. Foreign companies like Toyota and BMW represent one-third of all car manufacturing in the United States. They've built enormous operations in southern states that have offered tax breaks and a non-unionized workforce. Daniel Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, has been reporting this story, and he is still with us. Dan, you describe this second auto industry, and it seems to be taking a step ahead of Detroit.
Absolutely. It's been, you know, growing slowly and kind of under the radar for the last 15 years, but it just kind of burst into the public consciousness with the politics of the bailout, where you had all these Southern senators, Corker of Tennessee, Shelby of Alabama, opposing the bailout. And, you know, they don't like the big three because they're unionized, but they also see that these foreign automakers are huge employers. Together, they employ about 90,000 people directly. They've seen that these guys function without the type of work rules, without the legacy costs. They're major corporate citizens in these states. And so a lot of these Southern senators, they don't see the big three as their constituents, but they do see Toyota, Honda, BMW, Mercedes as their constituents.
And inherently, there's a conflict here, right? I mean, these are the Republicans who oppose any federal money going to Detroit, but their states have offered billions of dollars in subsidies to those foreign car makers.
Exactly. That's, you know, there was a race for incentives in the early 90s that is continuing today, because these southern states want these manufacturing plants. They're very high-paying jobs. They bring a lot of other investment and companies into the region. You played that clip from Bob Corker talking about Volkswagen. It's going to invest $1 billion in Chattanooga, bring a lot of jobs there, but it's getting incentives worth about $500 million, which is a lot of money. When Alabama wanted to bring Mercedes in the early 90s, it put together a $235 million package. Now, a lot of that is worker training. You know, they'll pay to train the workers, send them to Germany, get educated. They build roads. They guarantee free electricity. They abate property taxes, all sorts of goodies to encourage them to do that. And for the states, this has been a great investment because they come in with the incentives, and then their suppliers need to set up shop there who do not get the incentives. And then it creates jobs for, you know, trucking and shipping and restaurants and hotels and every type of business that surrounds a manufacturing enterprise.
And let's talk about some of those benefits, where the states are Kentucky, Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas. And what have these shops done for those communities and the states?
Well, they've really transformed the economy. You look at Alabama, which in 1995 didn't make a single car. Last year made 800,000. It's the fifth largest state in terms of auto production. These are generally poor states. Their jobs were focused in things like textiles and apparel, which have all gone offshore. And what do they have to replace it? They have agriculture, but they don't have much else. And so they've really created manufacturing industries from scratch.
You know, Dan, we were talking to a mayor of a city who was looking at a new plant coming in from the Kia Corporation. And when I asked him, you know, this point about a comparison with Detroit, he was very strident and upfront, saying that when Congress had the chance to look at the textile industry in our state and in our region, they did nothing. They allowed it to go completely down the tubes. We are damned if we are going to stand by and allow the federal government to bail out the auto industry in Detroit. Is that a palpable sense of rivalry on the streets down there?
I think that's probably a limited sense. You know, the textiles industry, I think, was a whole lot could not have been done to save them, given that you had China coming in with its, you know, wages at such a massive differential. So, you know, there were just some industries that were long term not meant to be here in the U.S. And I think, you know, the garment industry is one of them.
And clearly these companies, these foreign car makers, have not been immune to the current economic turmoil. How would you describe, though, how it's affecting those states and those companies as opposed to what's happening in Detroit?
Well, they're starting to feel the exact same pressures. Toyota's sales in the U.S. were off 34% in November, and they just announced yesterday that this huge plant they're going to build in Tupelo, Mississippi, to make the Prius, that they've kind of stopped work on it. And instead of being completed in 2010, it'll be done in maybe 2011 or a bit later. And a lot of these firms, they've done not so much furloughs, but they let go of temporary workers and some contractors. They have not done large layoffs yet because that's not their policy. They do have more flexible work arrangements, which means they're better able to manage the workforces they have. That's one of the advantages of not having union shops. And none of these plants in the South are union shops.
And Dan, as your final thought, how would you sum up the dynamics of what's happening in the auto industry, given what you've just laid out to us?
Well, basically, you know, we used to think that the auto industry was the big three. But basically, we have two auto industries. One is the big three. It's unionized. It's in the Midwest and mostly Democratic states. And then you've got Detroit South, which is non-unionized, foreign-owned, mostly in Republican states. And you can see how their interests are diverging. I should add one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob Corker, Richard Shelby, they represent states with lots of foreign automakers. So you can understand their opposition. But David Vitter, the senator from Louisiana, who was, you know, had that issue with the prostitutes a few years ago. Louisiana doesn't have many car plants from foreign manufacturers, but my theory is that several years ago, he ordered a Ford Escort and was disappointed to learn that it was a car. And so ever since then, he's been angry at U.S. automakers.
Oh, my, my. Daniel Gross, the senior editor, or a senior editor at Newsweek. And he's going to stick around with us. But now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh. He's got a few headlines for us.
At 28 minutes past the hour, President-elect Barack Obama is expected to name Chicago Public Schools Chief Arnie Duncan his pick for education secretary this morning. And there's word that Colorado Senator Ken Salazar will be asked to be Obama's Secretary of the Interior, and that announcement should come later this week. In Iraq, hundreds of people have been protesting for a second day as they demand the release of a journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush during a weekend news conference. An official said that the TV journalist had been handed over to the Iraqi military for questioning. And OPEC oil ministers arrived today in Algeria amid tight security. They expected to cut output significantly when they meet tomorrow. That's a quick look at your news headlines.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Today, President-elect Barack Obama is expected to announce his choice as Secretary of Education, his nominee. And we want to know what your advice would be for the new secretary.
As a teacher and a parent of a middle school child, I think one of the chief things that needs to be done in the next administration is to dismantle the testing that goes with no child left behind.
So what do you think? More resources, less testing, no child left behind? Should it go? Should it stay? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Well, Dan Gross, senior editor of Newsweek, is still with us. And in the break, we were talking about, you know, trying to figure out if our investments, our pensions, were involved in the Madoff scandal. And we both are reasonably sure that we're not involved. And so I guess we're counting our blessings this morning. But the SEC is digging deeper into the financial web of accused Ponzi schemer Bernard Madoff, who prosecutors allege has defrauded investors out of $50 billion. And yesterday, we spoke with New York Times senior financial writer Diana Henriquez, and she had this very disturbing thing to say.
There are people who were pretty wealthy people Wednesday morning and on Thursday morning were broke. I mean, it's the kind of thing that echoes of the 1929 crash that you read about in history.
Bob Chu, president and founder of PFI Communications, on the line from Montrose, Colorado. You there?
Yes, I am.
You're feeling that echo, aren't you?
Yes, I'm one of those people.
And when you say one of those people, literally, you lost everything and you learned about it last Thursday morning?
We learned about it Thursday night, and we haven't lost everything, but we've lost a substantial portion of our financial life.
And, you know, I don't want to, I mean, I was raised a Protestant, so it's hard for me to even ask about money, but, you know, how much are we talking here?
We lost $1.2 million on paper.
Whoa. Now, how do you even go about responding to something like that? I mean, are you calling lawyers? Or are you looking at your Social Security? What happens in a situation like that?
Well, you go numb first. You really don't know what to do. You know, we've been in a fog for the last, you know, 3 or 4 days, and just trying to figure out, you know, where we are financially. That's number one. And then number two, yes, you try to get some information. You get lawyers. You look around and find out SIPC is offering some help, they say. And you basically have to wait and see. This thing is just really breaking now, and nobody really knows where to go. That's one of the problems.
Now, one of the features of this scandal, and I want you to kind of take my hand and help me explore it with you, is that, you know, from what we understand, the Madoff operation was an invitation-only kind of deal where people were invited in, well-heeled investors down in Florida, other people that he knew, including some well-known names that are now being revealed. But in your case, your fund invested in his fund, so you were a couple of steps removed from Madoff. Did you even know who this guy was?
No, never heard the name. We were about three levels down. There are subgroups that then monies are, you are invited into a subgroup. The monies go to that subgroup. The subgroup then funnels the money up to another group that's just under apparently the Madoff organization. We never got past that one subgroup, if you will, and so it was always just the New York people. And that was something that we just had to kind of trust in, and it had been going for 40 years, and we had family members that had been in it since the late 1960s. So you just kind of went with the flow. It's been going on for so long, and it was so good that you just said, okay, let's give it a shot, you know. And it paid off. It paid off year after year after year after year.
Well, I want to talk about those balances and those returns that you were getting and just how alluring they were. But Dan Gross, you're still with us, right?
I'm here, yes.
You know why I told you to count your blessings, don't you?
Well, yes, I'm glad I'm not eligible to invest in some of these funds of hedge funds that put all their money with the Madoff operation.
Do you have a question for Bob Chu?
Well, yeah. Well, I guess two questions. Were you a direct investor, or were you in a kind of fund of funds that then went into him?
I suppose you could call it a fund of funds, in that it goes into a partnership, and that partnership then gives the money to another partnership higher up the line, and then that partnership deals directly with Madoff.
Okay. And was this partnership supposed to be diversifying and choosing among different managers, or was it the explicitly saying you invest in this partnership and you go into Madoff's funds?
You have no choice. It just goes. Okay. It just goes into the big pile, and you hope that it works out.
And they're the geniuses, right?
They're all the geniuses, right?
And Robert, you've been terribly blunt in saying that you and your wife were essentially living off the interest, and you got lazy. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, no, I have a business, and I have clients, and so we weren't living completely off the interest, although we have relatives that were. And I think what happens is when you get into a situation like this and the money seems easy, you kind of, you know, you don't have to work quite as hard. And I guess that's the great lesson we all can take away from this. And so, you know, when extra travel or trips or furniture or whatever it might be, you say, hey, let's dip into our fund a little bit and pay for it that way. And so you kind of get used to that, and you get a little lazy, and you don't work as hard as maybe as you should, and that's a mistake.
So, Bob, over the years, you took money out or were able to make withdrawals or get income from this?
Yes.
The way it works is you get quarter, you have a chance to get quarterly disbursements, and so you put in your request for disbursements each quarter, and they came.
And it's a cash kind of a cash machine. Well, Dan, we're going to have to say goodbye to you in this segment. Robert, just before we go, how much percentage rate returns are we talking about annualized over the time you were with Madoff?
15%.
15%, and it was too good to be true. Bob, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your story. Bob Chu is the president and founder of PFI Communications, and last Thursday night he discovered that he was a Madoff investor, and he and his wife lost more than $1 million. Dan Gross also with us. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama is expected to name Chicago Public Schools Chief Arne Duncan his pick for Education Secretary this morning. And Duncan has run the District of Chicago since 2001, working to improve teacher quality and turn around struggling schools. The CPI plunged 1.7% in November, reflecting a steep fall in energy costs, and the number of new housing projects that got underway also fell more than expected. It hit a record low of 625,000. Officials and a witness say a suspected U.S. missile strike has killed two people in a militant stronghold in Pakistan. The strike in the North Waziristan tribal region appears to be the latest in a surge of alleged U.S. missile strikes on Pakistani territory. There's a new political party in South Africa, and its supporters are celebrating. The Congress of the People, or COPE, will be the first serious challenge to the power of the African National Congress since the end of apartheid. COPE is made up largely of defectors from the ANC. The party was formed after a split with the ANC, following former South African President Thabo Mbeki being forced to resign. Let's look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. In Minnesota, they are still counting the votes for Senate there. The state canvassing board wants it done by Friday. Of the 2.9 million votes already recounted, incumbent Republican Senator Norm Coleman leads Democratic challenger Al Franken by fewer than 200 votes. But there are many challenges.
I'm just counting here.
210. Tom Scheck from Minnesota Public Radio. Razor-thin margin here, but it's far from over, really, right?
Hey, guys. Yeah, we actually thought it was going to be finished this week, but now we're going to have to – it appears we're going to have to wait a little bit longer because those nasty courts are going to get involved in this. The Norm Coleman campaign, Republican Senator Norm Coleman, requested that the court intervene and take a look at and create these uniform standards for deciding how to judge what is considered a wrongly rejected absentee ballot. And I know this is all very technical, but it's very important because the state canvassing board, which you mentioned, is going to start meeting this week, last week said to local elections officials, hey, you know what, we know you guys made some screw-ups. Go back, take a look, see if you screwed up on any of these rejected absentee ballots. And if you did, you know, if there appears to be some that were set aside that shouldn't have been on a legal basis, open those up and count them. And there are as many as 1,500, they say, could potentially come back in and be counted. So the Norm Coleman campaign, obviously they have a lead. They said, wait a second, we want to make sure that there's some uniform standard so a county in northern Minnesota doesn't say, okay, well, we think this person was wrongly rejected, but a county in southern Minnesota said, well, no, we're not really sure. So they want a standard all the way across. The Supreme Court's going to weigh in and have oral arguments on this on Wednesday, and there's no idea when they're going to have their say.
And in addition to all of that convoluted ingredient, there's also these challenges, right? I mean, there are thousands of votes that have not even been counted at all.
That's right. It's going to get down to about 1,500. Originally, they challenged these campaigns when they went through the recount and they started to say, well, we disagree with the election officials' ruling. There were about 6,600 ballots that were in question. The campaign started to withdraw those challenges over the last week, And it looks like they're going to have about 1,500 there that they're going to say, okay, we think that this is a vote for Norm Coleman.
The numbers just the numbers keep changing there. The numbers just keep changing. I just want to say that these ballots are on our website, so you can take a look for yourselves and judge how easy they are to understand or not.
Tommy, did they ever find that envelope they were looking for in the Lutheran Church?
Never did.
Never did. How many votes? How many ballots were supposed to be in there?
133, and the canvassing board said, we're going to take the election night totals because we don't think that there was anything nefarious that happened. It just got lost. There was a lot of legal rulings that said if this ever occurs, you know, take the election night totals, which they did.
They just lost the envelope, you know. Sometimes that happens, you know.
Sure does.
Sure.
So, Tom, what's the timeline? They're going to have a senator there in Minnesota by the end of the year? Any chance of that, you think?
Well, that's what the hope was, but the court said, well, just give us a deadline on when you have to certify and send something to the U.S. Secretary of the Senate, which is January 6th. So this may be bleeding into the new year, so to speak, here.
2009 in Minnesota, it's going to be Norm Coleman or Al Franken will be one of their senators. Tom Scheck, thank you.
You got it.
Tom Scheck is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio and our link to what's happening there in the U.S. Senate race.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 16th. Femi Oke has just joined us, and she's got the headlines of the morning.
Hello there. Time just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced yesterday that John Kerry will replace Joe Biden as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. Meanwhile, Dianne Feinstein will replace Robert Byrd as head of the Intelligence Committee. She'll be the first woman to lead the committee in its 32-year history. The Supreme Court ruled on a case that allows smokers to sue cigarette makers for the way that they market low-tar and light brands. The lawsuits can go forward based on state laws that protect consumers against deceptive practices. A security flaw in the web browser Internet Explorer makes its users vulnerable to computer hijackers. Internet Explorer is the default browser for most of the world's computers, and Microsoft said that it's considering fixing it through an emergency software patch. The Illinois legislature voted unanimously yesterday to form a bipartisan committee to consider impeachment for Governor Rod Blagojevich. And the governor says he doesn't plan to step down because he hasn't done anything wrong. But he has hired high-profile defense attorney Ed Jensen. And the Chicago Tribune is reporting that Patty Blagojevich has sent an apologetic holiday message to her neighbors. Illinois' first lady apologizes for the media barrage that's descended on their neighborhood and for the inconvenience and hopes for the sake of the kids that all the press will go away soon. And finally, within hours of an Iraqi journalist throwing his shoes at President Bush this week, the first shoegate video popped up on the internet. Check out your browser and put in a video game and shoes. See what you come up with. This is what I found. Flying Babush. So you use your mouse to make the president at the podium move away from the shoes, but the shoes come thick and fast. And if you're not careful, the president does get hit with the shoes.
Does that mean you win?
Hours of fun. See if you can beat mine. My score was kind of pathetic. I wasn't very fast with my mouse. Let's look at some of your news from this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
John?
Thanks, Femi. A new study takes serious issue with the effectiveness of tests to diagnose colon cancer that up until now have been considered very reliable.
I think the caution that doctors and patients should have is just to think that colonoscopy is not 100% effective. It's probably not 90% effective. It's probably on the order, based on the best evidence that we have now, I think about 60 to 70% effective, which for a screening test is really, really remarkable.
That's Dr. David Ranzahoff at the University of North Carolina. He's talking about a new study that comes out of Canada, and it's raising major questions. For more, we turn to Gina Colata, a medical reporter with our partner, The New York Times. Gina, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, the results of this study is going to come as a surprise to many. How do you explain what they found?
Well, I think part of the problem is that there had been, it had made so much sense the colonoscopies would be incredibly effective because, after all, what are you doing? You're putting a scope up someone's colon, and every time you see a little polyp, you snip it off. And polyps, 90% of them are fine, but there's a few of them that can eventually, over a long period of time, turn into cancer. So the idea is this is the perfect test. You find these little things, no big deal, snip them off, and you won't get cancer. So when people said, you have this, you can prevent colon cancer, it kind of made a lot of logical sense. Now it's turning out that it's harder sometimes to get to parts of the colon than people have appreciated. And when you get, even if you get to parts of the colon that are hard to get to, you may miss some of these little polyps for a lot of reasons, or there may be things that grow a lot faster than anybody expected in between colonoscopies, and so you may end up with cancer even if you had a colonoscopy.
So, Gina, is it a problem with the technology, the tools used to perform a colonoscopy, or is it about the doctors who are performing them?
I think that there's a problem with the biology of colon cancer, which is not as well understood as people had thought. There's a problem with the doctors performing the test, and there's a problem with patients preparing for the test. That's what people told me anyway. So there's three things that may be going on to explain why this test, although it's extraordinarily effective compared to almost any other test, is not quite what many people thought it was.
But there's an imaging question here. Basically, there are things that are going on in the colon that do not resolve well in the colonoscopy image, and they have to learn how to detect those events that previously they weren't paying much attention to. I guess I'm wondering, is there a sort of implication for the standard of care here? What age are men and women supposed to get on a yearly basis or, whatever, some sort of regular frequency, a colonoscopy? And does that change as a result of this?
People, the recommendation had been, many people, not everybody recommends the same thing. That's part of the problem, too. But for many people, what the recommendation was is you have one around age 50. If there are no polyps, everything's clean and clear, you can wait 10 years. And then people thought, okay, I'm guaranteed no cancer for 10 years. Because the idea is if you do get a polyp, it can take 10 years to develop into anything, so you should be fine. And that 10 years was sort of, that was... It was not based on really hard science. It's not entirely clear what the intervals should be. The American Cancer Society says it's not worthwhile trying to change the frequency at this point because there is some risk of having a colonoscopy anyway, that you could have a perforated colon. It's rare, but it happens, and the more you have, the greater your risk is going to be that it might happen to you. And then the other problem is that even though it's a leading cause of cancer death, colon cancer is still a rare disease, and chances are still really good that if you had a colonoscopy and the doctor said they removed or there were no polyps or they removed everything they saw, chances are really good that you're not going to get cancer in the next 10 years. So you're not going to add a whole lot of protection by having a colonoscopy more often, and chances are your insurance company is not going to pay for that extra colonoscopy.
But Gina, now armed with this information, is there some way that patients need to change their approach when they go in to see their doctor and they actually have one?
Well, there's several things that people recommended to me. One of them is you should really ask a lot of questions of your doctor. I mean, this is a test that many people find extremely unpleasant because you have to take these powerful laxatives to totally clean out your bowel. So one thing you want to do is make sure that if you're going to go through all this, first of all, you do it right. You're very, very careful and take all that horrible laxative. Secondly, one of the things that many people recommend now is that you take half the laxative the night before and half in the morning, because if you don't take it, if you wait too long between taking the laxative and having the test, This really thick, disgusting mucus can pour into your right colon from your appendix and cover up polyps and make it hard to see them. A third thing is check out your doctor. You should ask, you might want to ask, how many colonoscopies does this doctor do? They should be doing at least 3 or 4 a day. What's their detection rate? How often are they finding polyps? They should be finding them about 15% of men, 25% of women. How you should also ask them, how do they know that they saw your entire colon? You're supposed to get all the way through to the appendix. And is there a documentation? And good places to actually photograph the landmarks and say, here's how we know we actually got there.
Right.
So you can ask these questions and make sure that if you're going to go through all this, if there's anything there, there's a better chance that they'll find it.
In some sense, this is a lot like the track of mammography in that the test is really important, yet there's a certain art to it as you discover more and more complexity about the organ that you're looking at. You have to pay attention to different kinds of things than was originally thought.
Yes, it is. And the other thing that makes it kind of interesting is they're still developing, the American Cancer Society and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are now working on performance standards so they could say to doctors, here's how you know how well you're doing. With mammography, I think they're a little bit more advanced on that. They actually do go to centers that do mammography and try to assess how well they've done. So one thing that I was told is that if you don't tell a doc, if there's no way for a doctor to know how well he or she has done in colonoscopy, mm-hmm. they can think they're really terrific and they could be missing a lot.
Hmm. Well, good information to have. Gina Colata, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was fun talking to you.
Gina Colata is a medical reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and fascinating study, John.
Everybody's going to be looking at their medical history over the next couple of weeks. Barack Obama is going to announce his Secretary of Education today. What does he need to change in education?
We have got to learn Chinese so that we can be globally competitive.
Give the new Secretary of Education some help. Tell him how to start fixing any of the educational problems on day one at 877-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And one of you had a question about Ponzi schemer Bernard Madoff, whose prosecutors allege has defrauded investors out of $50 billion.
Did anybody check out this guy's last name before they gave him all of their money? Madoff? Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Fabulous conspiratorial listeners, and here's your takeaway.
Things are so telegraphed that the announcements are, I don't want to say anticlimactic, but it's not like we're going to get big surprises. We know what's going on in the economy, we know what the data points are, and we know that we're going to get an interest rate cut.
It's not a cliffhanger, says our friend Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, talking about the unsurprising things the Federal Reserve might do today. Our podcast can be subscribed at thetakeaway.org or at iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adoree Adoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.